What's up, everybody? Welcome back. This is episode number 3 with Dr. Rainer Meisterjahn. Rainer comes from Germany and is a mental performance coach for athletes. He comes from a small town, approximately the size of 238 people, Google tells me. He works with NBA, WNBA, NCAA, and some European players and coaches, and he's based in the States. Today we talked a lot about a lot of different topics. We talked about the techniques and the philosophy he uses on his players, the pre-game, in-game, and post-game processes and analysis he goes through with them. And we also obviously covered my favorite topic, the social media topic, how it affects players and how he helps them deal with all the attention they get. And obviously much, much more. It was a long one again, but I'm sure you're going to have enough time to listen through all of it and don't have to do it all at once. But once you do, please subscribe to this podcast. Please rate it. It helps me and it helps the podcast itself to just be rated higher. And I always strive for the best. So I'm hoping for your help on this one. Also, go to the YouTube channel if you have time and subscribe there as well. And leave a comment if you want. Meanwhile, please enjoy this episode with Dr. Rainer Meisterjahn. All right, Rainer, we're rolling.
All right, let's go.
All right, now the audio is good. Now we had a couple restarts here.
Couple of them.
nice to see you finally. We had a phone call 2 months ago, maybe a month and a half ago. And we both couldn't figure out where we met each other the first time. And we tried to remember because it was a long time since we've talked. But did you figure out by now?
No, not exactly. I'm still leaning towards 2014 Orlando Summer League. I'm pretty sure that's when it happened.
I think you are probably right. If I was a betting man, I would probably bet on Vegas because everybody bets in Vegas. But because the half of the basketball world is in Vegas during the summer. But I think Orlando sounds more realistic than Vegas in 2014. I think that was my first summer too. So yeah. So you know, I was debating if we should dive into this or not because I had a bad day and I was really close to canceling, but like asking if we could delay it or but I thought you know, at the end it's probably the best solution to have this podcast with you because that's your specialty. So I'll have my free session today with you. So but before we dive into the main topics, which I'm very curious about, there's a lot of things to unwrap here, and I have been a fan of this these topics and of this profession. I think it goes hand in hand with the coaching and scouting as well. But your beginnings struck me really as very special. I looked it up. I was trying to do as good of a research as a layman can do. I'm not a historian, but I was reading up a little bit about you more than before. And ARPA Germany, 238 people. That's a pretty unique place to grow up. 230 people. I would say it's. Would you say Midwest Germany or middle of Germany?
It's kind of western central Germany, roughly.
Yeah, yeah.
75 minutes from Cologne. You really did your research. If you actually know the population, I thought it was more than 230. I thought it was like 350 at this point, at least.
Well, 230. It's maybe Google is not updated. I don't know, but Google has not disappointed me yet. It saved my career actually a couple times. But how did you start playing the game? Because you played yourself in the past. You started off playing and you landed in this profession with a different profession. But how did you pick up the game of basketball in such a small town in Germany? And we'll go into your journey because it was pretty special from that point on.
Yeah, so I started playing super late. I was probably about 13 when I got into basketball. And at the time, we were just, you know, playing threes, like, outdoors pretty much with a, you know, handful of guys in the area that, you know, that were just hooping, yeah, just
all
for the
them.
Fun.
All of them.
um, I mean, it's kind of funny because I grew up in such a small village, and to even be able to run threes or fives, you know, you had to get kids from like pretty much multiple different towns.
I bet. Yeah.
So started out like that. Didn't really have any formal coaching until I was about 16. So initially, you know, I just played for the fun of it. Decided, you know, maybe a year or two in that I wanted to try and go to the States and really invest in my development, because everybody knew at the time that, you know, if you wanted to be anything in basketball, the U.S. was, you know, arguably the best place to be. You know, you might disagree with that.
No, not Lithuania. Lithuania is actually, I mean, is pretty darn good to be to start off playing basketball. But U.S. in terms of opportunities and. The process itself, the facilities and just resources is just a completely different level. Everybody would love to play there.
For sure. So in any case, when I was in the 11th grade in high school, I decided to do an exchange year pretty much. So I went to the States for a year, played at a super small high school up in Vermont. You know, got a taste of the culture. I got a taste of the, you know, just how basketball is coached, I guess, in this country. And just really just fell in love with the sport, you know, and from there, really decided that I wanted to see how far I could push it. So I went back to Germany, played in the club system there for a couple of years, not at a particularly high level, but, you know, at least I was in the club system where I had, you know, actual league play, actual coaching, et cetera. And then eventually went back to the States and was able to play for a small school up in Maine, where, you know, we had some, it was an NAIA school at the time, but we had, you know, a lot of D1 transfers and some pretty talented players up there. So I had a chance to walk onto the team, you know, play some games at the college level, and eventually went back to Germany, played semi-professionally for a year, did some coaching. And but then came to realize, like, you know, like, you're not going to make any money like playing the sport. There's really no longevity in it for you. And that's when I transitioned to mental performance, sports psychology, and went back to graduate school. And here we are today. So
yeah, but it's not a usual path to go back and forth like you did. I was wondering, how did you, like you said, you walked on, but how did you choose Maine and as your target NAIA college? I mean, that's like that was very specific, or is that just a college that was interested as well?
Yeah, so it was kind of crazy because this was before everybody had, you know, internet and all that. My family, like, we didn't have internet, I don't think, at the time. So, like, I would ride my bike over into, like, the next town. And one of my parents' friends, he had a marketing agency, so he would just let me use his computers and stuff. So I literally just researched colleges all over the United States and was just really trying to identify a handful of places where financially it was going to be doable for me, because I wasn't at a level where anybody was going to offer me like a D1 scholarship. Right. So I identified a, you know, small handful of schools that offered scholarship opportunities for, you know, guys like myself, based on a combination of, you know, being able to play sports, coming in with that international background, and also being a good student. So the University of Maine Machias was the one school that offered me more or less a full ride. So financially, it seemed doable. So yeah. That's what I went with, because, as you know, I mean, college in the States is just super expensive relative to what we're used to in Europe.
Absolutely. Yeah, I was lucky too. I only had one opportunity to go to high school. I came back from high school to Germany, and our paths are pretty similar. I didn't live in a small town, but I grew up in small towns as well. And coming back from the States, my senior year, I came back, and then I didn't know where I was going to go. I had just one offer to go to college, Division II, and that was like, you know, it's every time it's just one offer, one sliding door, and you don't know what the world would bring. So it's always fun when it works out in the end. but it's every kid's dream, I think, also to play in high school and college. It was my lifelong dream, so I'm glad it came true. But when you said, there's lots of self-awareness that goes into that, you know, deciding not to play anymore, because that's our passion and we want to play as long as we can. But did you have a mentor, or did you have some advice on the side that, like, for example, like Messina did in the first episode, where he was talking about how he just the coach pulled him aside and said, hey, you may not be a good player, but you may not turn out to be a player, but you could turn out to be a good coach. He was right. So better than that. But was that somebody that told you to do the same?
No, there actually wasn't, to be honest. I mean, I ended up, like I said, coming back to Germany, played in the club system here or there for that one season. And going in, I was excited. And then it just didn't work out the way I thought it would. You know, playing time was limited. You know, and then I started realizing, man, like just doing basketball all day, as much as I love it, I was like, man, like maybe I need more of an intellectual challenge, right? It might have been different, quite honestly, if I'd played more, if I'd played at a higher level and whatnot.
Right,
but
right.
I started realizing a few months in that just, you know, busting my ass every day, lifting weights, you know, doing like individual skills, doing team training and whatnot, the intellectual piece was missing for me a little bit. And I felt an urge to go back to school. Right. And so I decided to go back to the States at that point to go for my master's. Things kind of evolved from there.
But you went from a master's to a PhD in sports science. I mean, it's a pretty significant path you took on there. And how did you, like, there's other professions in basketball, like sports psychology is at that time. It was like, it's not, I wouldn't say it was stigmatized, but it's not many people talked about it at that time when you decided to go. By the time you finished, I mean, you chose the right path, no doubt about it, because now it's a huge topic, mental health and just sports psychology in general. What drew you to that topic, to that profession? Is there
It probably actually started in undergrad. So in undergrad, I was a psychology and behavioral science major, and we had a sports psych elective one semester that I took, and that really, I think, at the time sparked me to think about, you know, how can I combine those two passions of athletics and psychology into an actual career path. You know, at the time, obviously, sports psychology, as you mentioned, it wasn't as big a deal as it is now. But that's when I got excited about it. I mean, even going all the way back to my high school days in Germany, I'd always had an interest in how people think, how people behave, yep. You know, group dynamics, different things like that. So
That's exactly what I love too, man. That's something when you're living with a team, like the things that you observe, the dynamics within a team, within the locker room, outside the locker room, in the treatment room. I mean, there's so many different dynamics that you have to really consider. And if you're just not aware of it, walking into it blindly, you can get caught really badly in some situations that you didn't anticipate. But you know, like it's not given that you find an opportunity right away in the States, right? Like you go there, you stay, you finish with a PhD. But how did you go about, or how did you get your first client? What was the situation? Where's the starting point where you're like, all right, now I'm going to start my own thing, which you did. And then you like, how am I going to find my first client? What's the process there?
I would say probably by word of mouth and just coincidence, you know. And so I remember when I was going for my master's degree, which wasn't even in sports psychology at the time. My master's was in counseling psychology. But I remember doing a little bit of basketball skills training on the side, just to make a few extra bucks. So, yeah, I was training this female athlete at the time. And, you know, we'd get on the court, do some drills and stuff. And she just needed a lot of help around motivation or confidence primarily, I want to say. Right. So that's how it kind of started, through those type of informal opportunities where my foot in the door wasn't even mental training, but it was through basketball skills training. And then as I got more established over the next couple of years, it was, again, just by building relationships in the community while I was going for my PhD, and then even coming out of my PhD and not having a formal business, it was about building relationships with, at the time, I remembered that there was a basketball training facility down the road from my house. So I built a relationship with the owner, and he had an appreciation for sports psych. So they sent me a couple of referrals. And this was, you know, a couple of years before I officially started Cortex Performance.
That's like a lot of people underestimated, you know, like this little helping hand you get here and there, like this people believing in you and providing you with an opportunity. And then before you know it, it's really what the person is really meant to do, you know, and it takes off from there. But it always takes somebody opening the door for you, and then it's on you to really stomp through it, you know, or just, you know, like grab life by the horns, basically. But like you said, relationship building, networking, how do you go about gaining the trust of your client, of the players you work with? Because you work also with coaches, as far as I understand. So what's the process of building a trust between the two of you? Because it's, in reality, it can be really fragile, because people are, you know, they're warming up to you, then open up to you, and there's one little move that you could do, or not move, you know, it has to be like a synergy between the two of you, and once it breaks off, it can be done forever. But how do you go about of avoiding that? Is it intuition? Is it your just the thought process when you get to know the person? What's the connection there?
I think it's a couple of different things for me. So one, it's about how you introduce mental training or leadership development to the individual, right? Because a lot of, whether it be players or coaches, you know, they'll come in thinking that mental training is something that you only do when, you know, you're struggling with confidence or with, you know, as a coach, maybe keeping your team together or something like that. You know, but I really, from the start, I want them to understand that this is something we're going to do proactively. You know, you're here, or you should be here, because you're simply making an investment in yourself, and you know, mental training and leadership development is something that we're gonna look to stick with over time, just like you would with strength and conditioning, right? So really coming at them through that proactive lens, and then in combination with that, it's really about building a relationship with the person that's in front of you more so than the professional. Mm-hmm. So learning about their interests, learning about their background, finding commonalities. I mean, many of our clients on the surface might have nothing in common with me or my background, but you know, if we can maybe identify a mutual appreciation for sneakers, music, anything, you know, that fosters that connection, man, that's where it starts.
Yeah, it takes off from there. Usually you find, like, it has to be a common theme somewhere, right? That you feel like you, and because then it's a genuine connection. It's not like you're looking to get into somebody's head. It's like you're really trying to befriend them. It's a intent of really gaining a friend. It's an intent of helping the person and helping each other maybe to grow, maybe, because I think you can also learn from the player as much as he can learn from you, I assume.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've learned so much from players at all different levels over the years. And I, you know, what I most enjoy about my job is just the relationships that you build over time, and relationships that continue beyond the professional service that you might provide at the time.
Exactly. Yeah. Have you had a one profound experience from that you said, man, I've learned so much from this specific experience, without mentioning any names, but maybe like a certain situation where you were like maybe shocked or something that you didn't expect to happen, and you grew from that?
Man, that's a great question. I'm not sure if any one particular instance necessarily stands out, but it's just the, when you hear about the various experiences that these athletes have to navigate as they go through their careers, and all the, you know, like for overseas, like say like American guys that are playing overseas, how they go about navigating different cultures, and what the introduction is to a new team, where you're dealing with the language barrier, and you're dealing with, you know, sometimes treatment that might be considered inhumane in other countries, like for the NBA guys, you know, I mean, just navigating that world of just money and wealth and attention and everything that comes with that. I mean, there's just one learning experience after another for myself, right? And that's where I just love learning from the players.
So yeah, let's get right to that then. How do you, like, that's the thing that I was wondering the most, and I had it later on a little bit written down, but how do you make them aware, and how do you help them deal with all this attention? Because I imagine that, you know, like the problems were vastly different 10, 15 years ago. And now it's just like, also for coaches, man, the attention, the information flow is just all over the place. And right. How do you help them? Let's talk specifically first about the players to differentiate between what's important, what's not important. How do you help them to deal with it and not internalize all the negativity that's usually also found online?
I would say I try not to impose too much, because it's all too easy to come in as an outsider and be like, hey, like, you should stay off of social media because it's terrible for you, you know, and things like that. So I try to really learn from the player and look at how things are different for different individuals. Yeah. So when it comes to dealing with, say, you know, Instagram, Twitter, you know, we have athletes that most benefit from staying away from it completely. We have other athletes that actually find motivation in utilizing social media selectively, and maybe selectively looking at comments that other people leave on there. So I always want to hear from the player what they find most helpful to their own energy and what they find motivating. At what point does some of this outside attention actually get in the way? And so again, like, our process, it's about empowering players and understanding unique difference between personality types.
Yeah, but that's funny you say that, because Kyle, who was on the second episode, was also talking about using that as motivation. He was saying that he was taking screenshots and just, you know, going back when he had a bad day, going back to the screenshots and using that as motivation. That's pretty interesting. I mean, I get, like you said, individual, everybody decides, you know, not everybody is wired the same way. So I'm sure that there's a lot of things that you also have to figure out along the way to differentiate it. But has there been any, like, commonalities across the board that you say, like, this is a reoccurring theme with everybody from, like, let's say first players and then coaches? Like, is there one common theme amongst the two?
In terms of challenges that
challenges, challenges, problems that everybody seems to come to or talk about the same issue.
Well, I think for both populations, you know, energy and time management is a huge deal these days, you know, and I think a lot of that outside attention factors into that. And then it's also just, you know, how do you navigate pressure? How do you deal with your own internal life? You know, why is it like for an NBA player, for instance, or say for a European player that plays domestically and then also internationally, just looking at the travel schedule and the lack of sleep and the inconsistent nutrition and, you know, diet that might come with that. And then navigating all the scrutiny from the outside and all the people that are coming at you and want a piece of you when you're doing well. I think that's a pretty fairly consistent theme across players at the higher levels, and coaches deal with it, you know, in a somewhat similar way as well.
But what do you tell them? Like, what's the suggestion you give them in the process? Is it like individually for everybody, just like a separate program? How should I imagine that being dealt with?
Yeah, it's definitely customized to the individual, but we do look at different buckets in which we try to build skills, if you will. So for a player, and it'd be similar for a coach, as a matter of fact, but, you know, let's say for a player, you know, every player should have specific skills, specific daily routines that they go to establish some sense of balance in life. You know, those can be pretty extensive routines. They can be really simple things. An example would be teaching players to engage in a daily morning meditation and, you know, having them reflect back on the day at the end of the day, and then maybe having a certain nighttime routine that allows them to get quality sleep, as opposed to getting caught up in other temptations. So, you know, the day-to-day stuff, that's one bucket. Then we look at pregame, in-game, and postgame. So we look to build skills in those respective areas, again, to help the player stay, you know, more focused, more present-minded, and really go into each and every game and practice with a sense of purpose. Because the more we can go through life with a sense of purpose and intentionality, the more balanced and happy we feel at the end of the day. And when you're happy, you play well.
Absolutely. When you're wandering around without any, like, particular goal in, you can say purpose in life. And I just read a quote just recently by Sam Harris, and I'm pretty sure I'm going to butcher it. The purpose in life is doing things purposefully every day, you know, and it's if you are committed to doing things with a purpose every day, then you will find, you know, purpose in what you do. And I think that really you can grow from there and be happy. I think that's what everybody's seeking, right?
Right. Right. I mean, really what you're talking about is the process focus.
Yeah.
And being immersed in each and every moment. I mean, it's easier said than done. We all struggle with it. I struggle with it. I have the theoretical knowledge to understand what I can do to combat it. But, you know, despite my, you know, own routines, my own strategies, it's a struggle for all of us because there is so much coming at us, you know, with, again, through social media, but, you know, just being in a busy profession period and being somebody that looks to accomplish at a high level. I mean, you know, it is, you know,
yeah,
it's someone
course.
That strives in life and tries to get better.
Exactly. I mean, you want to improve in your life no matter what, no matter where you're at, even like athletes or coaches at the highest level, you still want to seek improvement in a day-to-day life, whether it's personal life, whether it's professional life. Like that is, you know, I think a common theme across athletes that are driven, that want to grow as a person and learn new things. And I think it's a pretty good trait to have. I think that life would be boring without that if you're just, you know, settled for less than what you're made for, because I don't want to wake up when I'm 85 and, you know, thinking like, damn, I should have done this, I should have done that. You know, like you want to live life to the fullest and grasp everything that God has given you God has given you this gift, and you should be able to maximize it, you know, and not waste it, you know, not waste your body for that. So, but how long do you advise them to meditate? If I may ask, what's the like time frame you say, or you just tell them like how you feel, whatever you feel necessary.
Yeah. Again, I think it depends on what the individual is comfortable with. My number, and I, you know, the reason I stick with it is because I read up on this a few years ago. I usually look to do at least 12 minutes. That seems to be kind of the magical number at which point, you know, when you do it consistently over time, you know, you see neurological changes in your brain.
Yep.
Now, I don't know if 12 minutes, you know, if it has to be that exactly, but what I do these days and what I have a lot of our athletes do is I've been utilizing Headspace, the Headspace app.
Yep.
And a lot of their meditations are right around, you know, 11 and a half minutes. And then I spend maybe a couple extra minutes after that. But, you know, sometimes we have athletes that maybe have a much shorter attention span, and instead of, you know, them doing it once a week or once a month for like 12, 15 minutes because they find it so strenuous, I'd rather they do it for 3 minutes consistently, you know, 4 to 5 times a week.
Yeah, 12 minutes is a nice NBA quarter length. prime them for their playing time and prepare them for the first quarter. But pre-game, in-game, post-game, let's do this. I'm having a bad day. I'm a player. Where do you start with the pregame routine? What cues do you look for in the in-game routine? And what's the process after the game? So let's start with the pregame. Where do you start preparing the player, and how do you go about getting him ready?
Right. So let's take a step back for a second. So in the very beginning of our process, with a new player, typically we have them develop out on-court core values because we really want to figure out what it is that the player wants to stand for between those lines. So it could be, you know, values like competitiveness or focus, efficiency, leadership, presence. Typically we condense it down to 3 and then look at what the tangible actions are that are going to inform those core values, to where, you know, me as a mental coach, I can watch a client's game and I can actually rate them based on tangible actions in terms of how well they're executing their core values. Mm-hmm. So let's say the player has their core values developed out, you know, then we carry those into the pregame routine. So during the pregame routine, you know, for a lot of our guys, we'll suggest engaging in some type of visualization for about, you know, 10 minutes, give or take, for example, you know,
visualizing themselves playing in the game and succeeding, or how do you, should I imagine visualization?
Yeah. So one, you know, obviously we want the player to pull their core values into what they visualize. Okay. The visualization, we oftentimes break it up into three components. So if you, again, if you picture it as a 10 minute block, you know, but which isn't set in stone, let's say it is 10 minutes, you know, you have about 3 minutes to go over your personal highlight film in your head. And you could literally even like watch a highlight video of yourself on your phone instead. But the point is you remember your best moments that you've had maybe in recent seasons to give you a boost of confidence, because sometimes we just simply forget what we're capable of when we're at our best. Mm-hmm. You know, once a player has done that, we also like them to sort of have a plan B in mind, which means, you know, I want them visualizing mistakes that realistically might happen, or if it's not mistakes, adversity that might realistically happen in the game, and then visualize responding positively to those. So mm-hmm. maybe seeing yourself miss a shot and then you know, bust your ass getting back on defense and you get a stop, you know, or you pick up a foul you're frustrated over, and instead of getting into it with the ref, you turn around, you engage with your teammates, you clap, you know, huddle up, those type of things. Because mm-hmm. most players we find, they'll go into a game with kind of a plan A in mind, and when that doesn't work out and they get into early foul trouble or get off to a bad start shooting the ball, the whole game just goes out the window. You know what I mean? Like refocusing. Then the last 3 minute block of the visualization is just game specific scenarios. So really going over plays, going over matchups, and seeing yourself execute in that regard. And then you can just wrap all that up with maybe a minute of deep breathing, kind of a mini meditation to get yourself centered before you might then go out on the court and
slow breathing. Slow and deep?
Yeah, slow and deep. Kind of relaxed and natural at the same time. I don't like it to be too forced. There are a million different ways in which you can go about your meditative breathing. But typically, just to keep it simple, just nice and relaxed from your stomach. You know what I mean?
Diaphragm through the nose, deep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's getting bigger and bigger, this breathing methods, and I'm reading this book Breathe. That's pretty insightful about all the different breathing methods that are incorporated and how important it is, really. Also, just to, like you said, to calm down and just navigate stress. So where do you go from there after the pregame?
So going into the game, let me rewind. So as part of the pregame as well, typically we have our players come up with, say, 2 to 3 focus cues, 2 to 3 themes, so to speak, for the game. So something like lock up defensively, lead with energy, maybe, you know. Mm-hmm. So then going into the game, you might use those short phrases or buzzwords, keywords as focus cues. That maybe you write them on your arm. Maybe there is some type of physical gesture that you go to serve as a reminder to engage in those type of behaviors mm-hmm. to make the most of your performance. And then obviously you can couple that with maybe some deep breathing when there's a dead ball, get a couple of relaxed breaths in if you're somebody who gets anxious, you know. But I like this idea of setting tangible themes and goals for the game, you know. Sometimes even say like from a leadership perspective, we might have players set tangible goals on behaviors that they're trying to engage in more frequently. So if it's a player that by nature is relatively quiet, for instance, but they're looking to step up their leadership behavior playing point guard position, a goal might be to initiate a huddle at least 3 times per half.
Okay. You set concrete goals for that player just to have like a little for him that in the back of his mind.
Yeah, sometimes it helps. Obviously, as you know, we don't want players thinking too much. Most of the time, players report playing their best when they're not thinking and they're just acting. But sometimes it's helpful to have tangible goals to strive towards when, you know, you're not really quite sure how to step up your leadership or, you know, get to a certain level.
But it's you also don't want to overload them with information, right? Like it's something that they like. there's also a road to achievement. Is you have to have realistic goals if you want to, you know, get fit. But people start off like going 100 miles an hour in the fitness facility because they want to get in shape, and then they quit after 2 weeks because it's just not sustainable. So, right. What's these all these small tasks like that you give to your players? They have to be achievable and sustainable throughout a long period of time. So, where like just also, I guess it's also customized, right?
Yeah, that's also customized, and it might vary even for an individual player week to week. And that's why we always look to get feedback. You know, we might set a tangible goal for one game, and then the player might come back after the game. We just talk it through. Hey, was it helpful to have that goal? Did it help your focus throughout the game, or did it take away from it? Was it too much? Was it too little? How do we want to change it? Again, yeah. the mental training sessions are really intended to foster a partnership between, you know, myself or one of our other mental coaches and the player, because the player is the expert in a lot of ways. So we really want to empower them to find their own voice.
Yeah. That's, I think, you know, it's a slow grinding process, and you have to trust in the process, but you also have to really, you know, like it has to, you can't just expect to have changes after a month, you know, made like there has to be, even if there is changes and you stop working with a mental performance coach, it could revert right back. Like you have to have like a foundation for it to build on. But if we're talking about during the game, what are the cues that you personally look for during the game when you see the player? Because as an assistant coach, you also kind of look if the player is like engaged, mentally engaged. Is he tired? What is he thinking? Is his shoulders are slumped or not? Like, are there certain cues that you feel like are really like attention getters or red flags during the game?
Yeah, I mean, there are probably some that are pretty universal across players. Obviously, when players are hanging their heads, or you notice they're getting overly involved with the referees or other factors outside of their control. But beyond that, I would again say that we really look at how, you know, like what's a player's optimal, you know, kind of optimal combination of behaviors, if you will. You know, I found that certain players, if we try to discourage them from engaging in what might be perceived as negative behaviors too much, then their overall emotional demeanor might be too flat. So some players might need a little bit of tension, a little bit of going at the rest here and there.
Right.
You know what I mean? We're going at a teammate, because otherwise all their positive behaviors might decline as well. So just looking at what's the optimal ratio, and just, again, understanding player tendencies and what different types of behaviors might mean for an individual. Sometimes we have players that might slump their shoulders because they're really discouraged, really down in their confidence. And for other players, that same behavior, while it doesn't look great from the outside, might be a way of refocusing and just getting, you know, getting more analytical for a second, thinking things through.
I can imagine it's like as much information as you have probably gathered throughout the years, that there's so much that you have to differentiate and put into buckets or cupboards, you know, that where you can say, okay, this player is this way, this player is a little bit different, this coach. Well, what about coaches? What about coaches during the game? What do you look for? What do they usually like complain about that is challenging for them during the game?
Well, a couple of things I look for are probably what's their overall level of engagement in terms of, you know, how much do they sit, how much do they stand, how much interaction is there with players on the bench versus players on the court, how much do they communicate with referees, how do they interact with players when they're coming out of the game, for instance. You know, those type of things. And the disconnect that I oftentimes see is that coaches, even really good ones, they might not be quite aware of how much small behaviors on their part can impact their players one way or another. So, you know, there might be a player that maybe they just went through a rough 5-minute stretch, you know, a couple of turnovers, missed shots, whatever. Now you obviously might have to pull them, right? Because you're trying to win the game. So as you pull them out, you know, just making eye contact with the player for a second, maybe smiling, maybe putting your arm around him to say a few encouraging words, or just giving it a positive touch, like that could mean the difference between the player, you know, coming out the same sluggish, you know, unfocused way the second half, or maybe they turn it around completely because they're like, okay, coach's got my back.
There's a fine line between that, I think. I get it. Like, there's every player has their trigger points where you kind of like you have to push the right buttons. But there's also, you know, like you treat one player for the same mistakes differently, or like you pull them on a mistake and you like others you don't. Then all of a sudden there's like, oh, there's a double standard in the team. We like coaches treating them differently than me. You know, like there's always cues and like not necessarily excuses, but things that are being pointed out, and the coach is the one to blame, or oftentimes, not a lot, but it's. I'm just trying to think from both perspectives, and there's always going to be some sort of gray area where conflict could arise. Have you experienced that?
I mean, yeah, for sure. You know, that double standard, if that's what a player perceives, it's never a good thing. So yeah, I guess like my question to you would be like, as a coach, how do you go about navigating that? Do you try to apply the same standard across all guys on a team, or do you go in and even, you know, say at the start of the season, tell guys, hey, you know, this is how I'm going to coach. Young guys, for instance, are going to be on a bit of a shorter leash, right? Older yeah. guys, when they make a mistake, my coaching style is so that I might keep them in, just so you guys know. You know, like what do you think is the best way to go about it?
I mean, I've never been a head coach at the professional level, except one time when I had to replace my dad and I had a technical foul right away. But I think that as a head coach, you would have to set the rules straight from the beginning, and there's no ifs and buts about it. There has to be a certain baseline for everybody to know, and certainly that you're going to have to talk to some players differently during the game in certain situations, depending on the situation. I think that you will not lose authority as a coach if you point certain things out to one player one way or to another player differently, because there is definitely this intuition that I go by a lot, and I see what the player needs at that time, and I feel like then you can address it, or as long as it's authentic and it's heartfelt, the players will respect it. If it's honest, the players will respect it. You know, like I think that you really have to be honest in the situation and see and say for what it is and not beat around the bush, because a lot of times that gets carried under the rug, and at some point the rug is going to be full of dust underneath, and then you're going to pull it up and it's going to be a dirt show. So I think that first of all, you have to set the rules straight and let, like, you know, like not necessarily say, hey, that's how I'm going to coach, but they have to feel right from the beginning, this is what it's going to be like. And a certain point, I would assume the players will also test the line to see how far they can go, how much they can drag, how much they can jog instead of sprint. And it's on the coach to address that right away, to catch those moments and not to let it carry over, you know, because once it carries over a second time, a third time, then it's going to get difficult to reel it back in. So there's a navigation process, but I think, like you said, from the beginning to set the rules straight without necessarily like writing it on the board or anything, like, you know, like I think it should be self-understood. That's my feel. So let's go to post game. So what's the post game analysis like, and do you do some video analysis? Do you talk to the player individually for dinner, or what do you talk about at all?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes we do some video, though typically not the night of the game. But you know, a simple process that we have all of our athletes engage in typically is we have them reflect back on their core value execution and on their game plan execution. So we're actually in the process of developing out an app that our clients are going to have, to where they can, you know, come in post game, they see their core values in front of them, they can rate themselves, say on a scale of 1 through 5 on how well did they do in each area. And then they also rate themselves on their game plan execution, which is the cues, the themes that we talked about earlier for pregame. And then we typically have our clients do a simple, we call it an S3 analysis. So it's strengths, struggles, and strategies. So what did I do well? What did I struggle with? And then what are my strategies or adjustments to get better next game? So that's real simple, but it's a way of reflecting. So you go out of the game with, you know, with again, more of a sense of purpose and learning, as opposed to getting caught up in the disappointment over a bad game or the excitement of a great performance.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that's very purposeful and really straightforward how you measure it, I guess, how you reflect on it. But that's my next question. Also, I think it fits into this realm. What's the, because we are in, and we're living now in an analytical world, right? Like there's everything, there has to be some kind of justification for certain things, for certain actions, for the statistics. How do you go about measuring it? Because we know that like a good streak for a while, it doesn't necessarily have to be traced back to a mental performance. And I'm challenging you here. I know, like I'm challenging you in terms of measurability and you know, like maybe it's a placebo effect. I'm just trying to play the devil's advocate basically here. So what are the intangibles, or how do you go about measuring it over a course of time?
It's such a great question. And the simple answer is it's difficult, and it's probably in a lot of ways, it is subjective. Of course, you know, I know people that'll, you know, maybe tie back certain interventions, strategies, methods that they taught the player to performance statistics. But I'm always careful to do that, because just because a player might increase their PPG by, you know, like 5 points over, you know, 3 months, doesn't mean that mental training is what accounted for that. Maybe mental training helped in some kind of way, but maybe they also, in the meantime, you know, connected with a basketball skills coach for extra reps, or, you know, they did some extra film study. So from that standpoint, it's really difficult to measure improvement in mental performance. And a lot of it is honestly just via honest and direct conversation with the player and with the coach, you know, and I think that's where it's perfectly not only fine, but also important to gauge perception. You know, is the coach seeing a change in body language by the athlete? Does coach mm-hmm. feel that the athlete is being more aggressive? Of course, he can dive into, you know, the advanced analytics and see if, you know, is the player attacking the paint, you know, more than before on right. average, right. you know, because they're more confident, but it's difficult. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, I think it's over a course of a certain period, right? Like it can't be just a glimpse of a change. Like it has to be a long, sustainable, visible change. And it's, I think that not every player probably needs a mental performance coach, but certain players who admit to it, because I think the first step is to admitting that you need somebody to help you focus, to help your performance mentally, to stay engaged and not drift off, because the attention span, lack of attention span also has become a problem because of you know, you can trace it back to social media or you cannot trace it back. I mean, but there is studies have been done that there's a lot of tracing back towards the start of social media. But I think that every player, like you said, there's, depending on the player himself or herself or the coach, if they feel like they need somebody, they need to seek it out. And I think they should be advised by somebody to seek a mental performance coach, because it can just, some people are more liable to change, or more adverse you know, not seeking out, and they're scared of going out and finding somebody to help them. So I think that we need to encourage and talk about it more. And that's, I think, it boils down to that.
Yeah. And I mean, that's where we need to really distinguish between mental health and mental performance, because to me, with mental performance, while it starts out as a need a lot of the time, I'd really much prefer that players ask themselves, is mental performance something I want? Is mm-hmm. it something I desire? Yeah. Do I want to get better? You know, and what I've really seen with our business that's been encouraging the last couple of years is that we have more and more athletes reach out because they simply want to grow. They do look at it as strength and conditioning for the mind. You know, I got a message from a female professional player a few months ago, and she reached out. She's like, hey, like, I'm interested in, you know, working with you. Like, you know, is that something that you'd be open to? I'm like, yeah, sure. You know, let's connect and whatnot. And so turns out that like she'd done mental training for years. Like she was you know, she already had a bunch of set routines, you know, just extremely well prepared, you know, as good as anybody I've ever dealt with at any level, you know, and she's putting up like pretty much like 35 a night, dominating her league. And she's like, I just want to get better. Like, I want to learn a couple of more things, you know, that can help me. So that's we're trying to move towards.
Yeah. Now that's something, I think that's the ideal situation when a player is seeking, like we talked about earlier, you know, like this eternal growth. And it's difficult, you know, it's obsessive as well. I think that there is a fine line also not to get crazy and too perfect about it, because perfectionism does not exist, and we do seek it. We try to strive for it, but it does not get there. So that's my question to you also. You've probably seen, like you mentioned, like there's perfectionists out there that are trying to do everything right, and it's good. I'm not saying it's bad, but it's a good thing. Is the flow state or the zone, as we call it, is it achievable on a consistent basis, or is that something that happens just by chance, or just by you feeling it that day and the stars align?
Yeah. So I love the question, because it's something that gets debated so much in our field, and there are probably, you know, numerous mental coaches out there that would tell you that they can help players, you know, get into the zone pretty frequently, maybe all the time. I personally, I don't believe in that, because, you know, I've played, you know, I watched a lot of players. I watched high level players, and by and large, I mean, even when you look at, you know, like the Steph Currys of the world, you know, it's not like they get into the zone every single night, or not even every other night, or every third night. Yeah. The reality is that basketball is a game of adversity. So yes, you can do things like the pregame routine, the breathing, the focus cues. Like, you can do all those type of things to give yourself a better chance of getting into the zone.
Right.
But I would never, ever plan on it going into a game. Like, you got to learn how to win ugly as much as anything, and to not sustain your high level focus and, you know, make every shot, you know, throughout the duration of a game, but to learn how to refocus over and over and over again.
Yeah. Yeah.
When adversity hits, you know?
Yes. Like, you have to learn to dig yourself out of it when you fall into the pitch, right? Like, that's I think that's the biggest challenge for a lot of athletes. And like you said, like, not necessarily striving for the zone, because I think it happens, like you said, it happens as if you you use all the tools necessary, and then it just comes into play in this situation because of the opponent, because the defense is, because you hit one shot, you hit another shot, and then just things just start rolling and you start feeling good about yourself. But what, when you're in a slump, shooters get into a slump. I've been into a slump when I was playing. I've seen players get into a slump all the time. And, you know, it's a mental thing, because you start playing around, you know, mechanics here and there. What do you advise for the players? Like, look, relax, or do you go back to the foundation, fundamentals? What do you do when players fall into a slump?
Again, it depends on the individual player, I would say. So we got to see kind of what the root cause is. You know, is it overthinking? Is it, you know, maybe physical fatigue that can be addressed with better sleep patterns, perhaps? But oftentimes it's about helping the player direct their focus in ways that are more productive. So what happens is that sometimes when we're in a slump, we get too internal with our focus, and we start thinking about, am I bending my knees enough? Is my elbow in far enough? And we start experimenting in ways that are really not conducive to a high level performance in season. You know, if you want to make, you know, tweaks to your form, that's something for the off season, most likely.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
I mean, like, a lot of players internalize their problems. They just eat the frustration, eats them from the inside out, and every miss becomes a bigger miss, you know, and then just like a snowball effect takes place. And, you know, it can carry over to game to game, because it's naturally you start internalizing things, but that's when you know, mental performance comes in and kind of puts things into perspective again.
Yeah, and that's where we can also bring in a lot of the motor learning and skill acquisition type of content. You know, a lot of that is about how do you direct your visual focus, and like, what type of cue do you even give yourself to execute a movement pattern. So think about the difference, like when I'm in a slump, you know, think about the difference between thinking, man, like, you know, bend your knees, keep your elbow in, you know what I mean? Like snap your wrist as you're going up into the shot, as opposed to shoot the ball to the target or pass the ball to the target. You know what I mean? Eyes on the rim, you know, shoot it to the rim. Like having that external cue is way more beneficial to your body simply getting back to executing a movement that it's done over and over again.
Yeah.
There's no need to interfere with it. We need to step out of our own way and just let the body do what it does by directing our focus appropriately.
Absolutely. I can't agree more with that. I think that there's like, I personally keep referring to my, because I mean, that's naturally what you refer to when you play, that it was just the less of, obviously you cared about the shot, you know, it has to, like, the technique, everything, you practice a thousand times, million times. But I found myself, the less I thought about, the less I cared, you know, care may be the wrong word because it kind of doesn't put enough weight on the shot, but the less I cared and thought about it, the better I've shot. And it was just like, it just like you said, it was a natural shooting motion and flow, and you just kind of like, you find the flow in the game, and then it just naturally, you feel more confident with that. So I think there's like less thinking is more. So that's basically the experience.
I think also, if I can, you know, add this real quick, like just helping players get back to this idea of how can I be a game changer out there? How can I have an impact? So oftentimes when a player we have is, you know, dealing with a shooting slump, we don't even really spend much time talking about the shot. You know, we get back to, all right, like, let's assume you're going to shoot 0 for 10 again next game. How can you still have such an impact on the game that coach is going to keep you out there because you're, you know, you're bringing tremendous energy, you're clapping, you're engaging with teammates, you're locking up defensively, you know what I mean? And then all of a sudden, before you know it, shots are starting to fall again because you're not so hyper-focused on it.
Very good point. Very good point. That's Brad Stevens says that the game rewards toughness. And usually when you play tough, when you play defense, you slide, you bend your knees, you play physical, the game will reward it, and you will for the shot, you do need your legs, and you activate the legs through like taking focus away from the offense and focusing on a defensive end. Try to take charges, try to play hard, slide, try to get a stop. And then all of a sudden, you're going to feel better about it. You're going to feel more physical. You're going to feel more crisp. And that's when the shots, I think, will drop again. I think that's the biggest difference maker there for players in game.
Sure.
But you also my research skills also played it here, came out of me. You also do NBA draft interviews, huh? That's something I didn't know. So what are some cues you look for when you interview? Because that's really actually important for my scouting job as well. What are the cues you're looking for when you're interviewing or talking to a player? And is there any specific questions you ask to find out like deeper underlying problems or issues that could arise later on?
Yeah. So one, we do our interviews in combination with personality assessments. So our main goal is to understand the player in terms of, you know, how are they wired? What motivates them? What is their level of self-awareness? You know what I mean? So no matter what the question is, you look at level of specificity with which a player can answer. You know, we look at just basically, like we do.
Basically, are they living in reality or not?
Yeah, for sure. That's a big part of it. That's a big part of it. You know, so if they claim that they're a hard worker, for instance, which are, you know, all these guys are going to give you standard type of answers like that, right? Like every single guy you ever talked to in the NBA pre-draft process is the hardest worker in the history of the world. As you know, right? So then it's about asking targeted follow-up questions like, hey, give me some examples of how that hard work shows, you know? What does a typical, you know, day look like for you? When do you get up? You know, how many reps do you get in? Talk me through some drills. What does it look like? You know what I mean?
So you let them talk a lot and you ask specific questions that are not really, that should be open-ended, right?
Yeah, open-ended questions as much as possible. Absolutely. So the player essentially gets to tell their own story, and we in that process we also are trying to you know help the player find some courage in being vulnerable, right? Because that's also something important that you want to keep an eye on. Is the player courageous enough to speak to things that they struggle with? And have they thought about tangible solutions? So if they have a hard time with consistent confidence, do they have certain, you know, methods, skills, tools that they go to address it? Where have they never thought about it? Right. So we actually run the interviews in a way that's pretty similar to a mental training session. We try to really establish a relationship as much as that is possible in that context and help the player present themselves to the organization in the most authentic kind of way. And you know, as opposed to asking a bunch of tricky questions or anything like that. You know, to me, an authentic partnership, even in the interview process, is much more beneficial to both parties than if we try to be tricky about it.
Yeah, but that's also like you're not trying to like playing the gotcha game, right? With the player, that's not a fair game, obviously. But do you dig into the background a lot and to see if there's underlying problems that like are deeper rooted, just to see what their reaction is, or is that something you just don't touch if you know there is some heavy stuff in the back?
I mean, typically it's the organization that'll do that type of research from what I'm telling a player. So if the organization tells me, hey, like we know that this guy, you know, they dealt with, you know, maybe a domestic violence type of situation a couple of years back, you know, it's something that typically I tend to just bring up directly and say, hey, you know, as you know, these organizations, they do a ton of homework on you here. They came across. I'm curious to just hear from you what it was like going through that. You know, what did you learn from it? You know, what might you do differently if you had a chance to go back and do it over again? So I tend to not beat around the bush and then like bullshit the player, because the player deserves transparency and authentic interaction.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, though, just to see what they would do differently if they had if they made a mistake in the past, and what, you know, like there's obviously like answers that they can give the same one to everybody, but if they give something special, then you learn a lot about that person from that one sentence maybe, or that one like specific topic that they bring up. But what would you have done anything different in your past, in your path? Is there something that you regret not following up on, or you feel like you should have done more in a specific direction?
So I'm happy with where I'm at today. But if I could go back in time, knowing what I know now, I'd probably do a lot of things differently. You know, starting out as a basketball player, you know, I was always the type of guy that probably outworked everybody. Not probably, like I know I did, you know? So that's what I was good at. But I also put a lot of pressure on myself that, you know, caused me a lot of performance anxiety. Yeah, things like that. And I didn't really know how to address it. So I ran myself into the ground physically a lot of the time without addressing the mental challenges. Mm. So that, you know, starting out, I would for sure do differently. And that might allow me to become a much different type of player than I was, which, you know, maybe it would have shifted my career in different directions.
Yeah, that's the catch 22, right? Like you probably wouldn't be right where you're at right now. Like, I mean, that's a blessing in disguise, that you didn't have a mental performance coach at that time, then you wouldn't be, your career maybe would have been delayed by 10 or 15 years, you know, which takes away a lot as well.
Right, for sure. Going back, you know, if I could do anything differently as far as my current career, I'm not sure if I'd go for the PhD, honestly. Maybe I'd just get a master's in performance psychology, and then also invest actual time and classwork into how do you actually run a business? Because I came in with zero business background. So I'm self-taught, right? And I just, in the past year, finally brought on a business manager to help me figure out a lot of the stuff that I just really had no clue about.
That's not the first time I hear that. A friend of mine, she also has a PhD, and she's like, if you had a chance, don't do it. Just like it's a huge burden. And I mean, it's a probably like sense of accomplishment, but it's still heavy duty stuff. So kudos to you for sure. But where do you feel like there's a difference in acceptance between Europe and US, because you have a multicultural background and you've seen both sides of it? Is there a shift coming in terms of acceptance? I feel like it's opening up more by a lot, you know, judging just by the information that's out there now. But what do you feel is the acceptance? Because in soccer, football in Europe, it's been accepted for a while. And a lot of teams have mental performance coaches and sports psychologists.
Right. I've seen it both ways, quite honestly. And I've talked to a lot of people about this. And some will tell me, man, like the U.S. is so much more advanced, you know, and then other people are, you know, they kind of feel the opposite way about it. I think it maybe depends on the sport a little bit.
Yeah.
Mental health is kind of the big movement right now. And we, you know, we don't deal with mental health as much as we deal with mental performance. But because you've had, you know, guys like Kevin Love, DeMar DeRozan, you know, speak out about mental health, it's also, I think, opened people's eyes to more proactive mental performance training, which obviously benefits us in our position. I think Europe, you know, like you said, in soccer, it's more integrated, and in the basketball space, it's probably more difficult. Not in every country, not in every organization, but I would say that Europe is maybe a bit behind on the basketball side relative to the NBA right now. But again, it just depends. It's like, you know, it differs so much organization by organization.
It's also a big budget thing, I think. I mean, like in football, like in Europe, you have in European football, you have just such a big difference in budgets that you can allocate millions and thousands of euros or pounds or whatever the currency may be to mental performances, sports science. I mean, the departments are just through the roof. So I think that's a budget thing in the basketball department. But what do you doctors, if I may call you that, doctors need doctors too. What do you do to calm yourself down, to find balance, and to really centralize your align yourself again?
Yeah. Before I answer that, just so you know, I got to step off in about 5 or 6 minutes because I have to talk to my accountant because you know, I need help with the business stuff. So
that's good. We're finishing up.
All good. Yeah. So you're absolutely right. I mean, somebody in my position, just like the rest of us, I mean, we all need our own way of managing our mental game, if you will. So for me, it is my daily meditation practice that I go to in the mornings. I keep a gratitude journal at night. I exercise a lot. You know, I try to carry that mindfulness out into my life as far as my interactions with other people. You know, I mean, I try to be mindful about how my diet and my sleep patterns, my water intake, how that impacts my mental and emotional states. So of course I have to be up to speed and all that and really live what I preach. That doesn't mean I'm perfect at it. I have my own struggles, but I try to really make a commitment so I can model what I try to teach to our clients.
Yeah, those are all things that I find important. And I hear them. I listen to a lot of podcasts and I hear all those little things you just mentioned. The gratitude journal is not the first time I hear it. So it's kind of, it's difficult to have that routine, but it's important as well. I think you have to sometimes force yourself into it. Maybe I'll force myself into a gratitude journal too. you have any specific book on mental performance that you would recommend? If it's one book, I read The Inner Game of Tennis was pretty good. But if you have something that's helpful for laymen, not too difficult, not too technical to read, it will be great.
Yeah, Inner Game of Tennis is great. You know, classic read. I mean, it's been around for a long time, and the concepts still hold. You know, so that's a good one. Mind Gym is a classic. That's an easy, fun read. Heads Up Baseball 2.0 is a great book that has some pretty great applied stuff in it. Even if you're not a baseball guy, which you know us Europeans, like we most of us don't really grow up with baseball, so
yeah.
But it has some really great applied stuff in it. The Mindful Athlete by George Mumford is a great book. Yeah, so those would be a few go-tos. I mean, I'm sure there's a bunch of others I can't think of right now, but
those I've heard before, and I haven't read all of them, but I've definitely, they've been on my book list. So good, Rainer. thanks a lot for your time. I want to let you get you to your accountant and make sure the business holds up right. And I will link to all your to the Instagram account, to your webpage. It will be all in the show notes. If you want to mention it quickly, it's up to you. But everything will be below in the show notes or on my webpage. And I appreciate your time. And for the German listeners, wir machen das nächste Mal auf Deutsch. Wir machen noch.
Thanks for having me, man.
Danke dir.
Danke.